Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
With the changes to how Canadians are able to access journalism on social media, you'll always be able to find news you can trust on the CBC News app. Get your news without restrictions. Download the free CBC News app today.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and in the early hours of Friday, the 22nd of December, these are our main stories. The UN warns of impending famine in the Gaza Strip.
Pretty much everybody in Gaza is hungry. More than 500,000 are starving.
A student in Prague shoots 14 people dead on his university campus, the worst mass shooting in Czech history. And Rudy Giuliani, former New York mayor and Trump ally, seeks bankruptcy protection over a $150 million damages award. Also in this podcast, why ABBA is having the Taylor Swift effect on London's economy. And...
Well, I'm surprised I'm still here. I've been a sinner all my life. I've been a bad boy. I'm just grateful to get up in the morning. I paint and I play the piano.
The Oscar-winning actor Anthony Hopkins on his life and his new film, One Life. Two UN agencies have issued fresh warnings that there are no functioning hospitals left in northern Gaza and that people across the territory are facing catastrophic levels of hunger. In its latest assessment, the World Food Programme's chief economist, Arif Hussein, said many people are on the verge of starvation.
That report just confirms our worst fears. Pretty much everybody in Gaza is hungry. More than 500,000 are starving. One in every four people is starving in Gaza as we speak.
The UN found that Gaza's entire population of 2.2 million people were suffering acute shortages. Some basic supplies are getting into Gaza, but aid agencies say it's nowhere near what's needed, and distribution is being severely hampered by Israel's continued intense military operations. Many hospitals are no longer fit for purpose. Our correspondent Shaima Khalil sent this report from Jerusalem.
Yet again, the sound of shelling in Gaza. And there is no sign of respite. Hamas officials say an Israeli strike near the Rafah crossing killed four people, including the director of the Israeli-controlled Kerem Shalom border crossing. Israel's military said it was not familiar with the incident. The World Health Organization says the bombardment has left northern Gaza without a functional hospital, with patients in need of urgent treatment at risk of dying from wound infections. Sean Casey from the WHO was part of yesterday's mission to hospitals in the north.
The whole of northern Gaza now has no functioning operating theater, no place for any woman who needs to deliver by cesarean section, no place for post-operative care. And as a consequence, we're seeing an enormous amount of suffering. What I saw in Al-Ahli yesterday was patients essentially waiting to die.
Hamas has continued to fire rockets, with sirens sounding in southern and central Israel.
You enter inside, you see a workshop for tunnels. They're building tunnels here. Come with me.
The Israeli military says it's uncovered a network of tunnels in the heart of Gaza City, with entrances connected to the houses of Hamas leaders, including one of the masterminds behind the October 7th deadly attacks. Diplomatic efforts are continuing. The Foreign Secretary, Lord Cameron, has said that Britain is pushing for consensus on a new UN Security Council resolution to bring in more help.
Everything that can be done must be done to get aid into Gaza to help people in the desperate situation that they're in. Yesterday I was in Jordan where I saw the aid being loaded up. That now is coming from Jordan into the West Bank, into Israel, into Kerem Shalom, and we need to see that grow. That is a good route for more aid.
It's hoped that a deal could lead to hostage releases. Although so far, Hamas has said it will only free more if there is a full ceasefire. The group's leader, Ismail Haniyeh, is still in Cairo for talks. An Israeli official confirmed there were no current negotiations with the group. but that communication with key mediators was ongoing.
Shaima Khalil reporting from Jerusalem. Meanwhile, at the UN in New York, diplomats have been continuing their efforts to agree the wording of a resolution in Gaza. One sticking point was a proposal to have a UN mechanism which monitors aid entering Gaza. Arab countries are demanding this, but the US fears this could take control of the screening process away from Israel. A vote by the 15-member Security Council has been delayed three times so far this week. So, could there be a vote tonight? Our correspondent at the UN is Neda Torfik.
The best I've heard from diplomats is they'll see where they are at the end of negotiations. The earliest would be at the start of this evening, but it's extremely difficult to tell given how these last few days have played out.
And what's the mood among the people you're talking to in the UN building?
Well, there has certainly been a mix of emotions. I think there's a lot of frustration from all the other members on the council who are ready to move to a vote, who say they want to move to a vote. They are very aware, though, that the United States doesn't want to be in a position to have to use its veto for a third time and is trying to reach an agreement. So there is, I would say, kind of constructive engagement on the council. But you can see as the time is wearing on, everyone is just eager to get this to a vote already.
The more watered down, though, any wording gets, the less use it's going to be, surely.
And that's really the position of the UAE who put this draft forward. At first, there was this idea, let's get rid of the mechanism altogether. They said, no, that's a hard line for them. They don't think the resolution would be meaningful without it.
Neda Torfik at the United Nations. The Czech Republic has suffered its worst mass killing. A 24-year-old man shot dead at least 14 people at Prague's Charles University, where he was a student. The gunman was later found dead, although it's unclear how he died. The Prime Minister, Petra Fiala, has expressed his shock.
First of all, let me express my deepest condolences to the relatives and friends of all the victims. None of us can fully imagine the depth of grief and pain that they are now experiencing. Many lives, mostly young people, have been needlessly lost. Like many of you, I feel deep sadness and disgust in the face of this senseless and brutal violence.
Our correspondent Sarah Rainsford in Prague gave me an update on the latest just before we recorded the Global News podcast.
Well, I'm just standing on the bridge now, looking right over towards the Faculty of Arts of Charles University. The lights are still on. In fact, all of the lights are on in that building, but there are blue flashing lights all around of police cars because the square in front and the blocks around this building have been cordoned off still by police. There is an emergency meeting taking place just in the other direction, close to where I am as well. The government meeting with the president and the head of parliament to discuss what has happened, because this is an unprecedented attack. It's the worst mass shooting in Czech history. Obviously, police investigation is underway, but they have been giving some details about the man they believe is responsible and his motives. They are saying they don't know his motives. He was apparently a high-performing student, but they do believe that he killed his father in a location outside of the city, and then he headed for Prague. They believe that they had information he was heading here, an armed man who was planning to kill himself. They then tried to prevent him from doing that, but 14 fellow students within the Faculty of Arts here were shot dead. And we know that at least 24 people have been injured, some of them extremely seriously injured in that attack.
Sarah, just take a listen to this clip. It's a witness, one of the professors at the university.
So I was in the auditorium. I was giving a lecture at the moment. We first didn't quite realize what happened. And then at some point, the special operation troops, you know, went storming in. They searched the room briefly and then went out, after which they stayed us to told us to stay inside. And then 1 hour later, another police squad broke in and then put us on the floor, briefly searched us, and then evacuated from the building.
Sarah, the country in shock.
Yeah, that's right. This is on a scale that no one has ever seen before. People in shock, people horrified. The Prime Minister talking about an utterly unjustified attack, talking about his deep sadness and his disgust. The police also saying that they discovered a huge arsenal of weapons and ammunition, and saying that this attack could have been even worse than it was, although, of course, it was horrifically deadly.
Sarah Rainsford in Prague. The president of football's governing body, FIFA, says nothing has been changed by a ruling from the European Union's highest court that football's governing bodies were wrong to ban a breakaway Super League 2 years ago. Gianni Infantino says they organised the best competitions in the world and this would continue. The company behind the project has since announced plans for an even bigger tournament. Our sports news correspondent Alex Capstick has been gauging reaction to the announcement.
Plans for the Rebel tournament collapsed soon after they were first revealed in April 2021 amid widespread protests among fans. This ruling has revived the idea of a breakaway competition. It was welcomed by the only remaining clubs from the original venture, the Spanish giants Barcelona and Real Madrid. UEFA's president Alexander Šeferin said the organisation wouldn't try to stop the creation of a new league, but questioned how much support it would get, suggesting it would involve as few as two teams. The British government doubled down on its determination to protect the domestic leagues. The Home Secretary James Cleverly said with a new independent regulator for English football on the way, there would be legislation to prevent clubs from joining a breakaway competition.
We were deeply uncomfortable with a breakaway league. The fans told us they didn't want a breakaway league. The fans told us they wanted us to take action, so we have taken action. We'll continue to do so to make sure that fan-led review and the findings that have come out of it are implemented and will be underpinned through legislation.
Manchester United and Bayern Munich have both issued statements saying they're committed to UEFA's competitions, while Spain's top division, La Liga, described the Super League as a selfish and elitist model. Fan groups across Europe were also dismissive of the new proposal.
Alex Capstick. The authorities in Paraguay say they've regained control of their largest prison, which was being controlled by an imprisoned gangster for 2 months. At least 11 inmates and a police officer were killed in the big operation to wrestle back control of the Tacumbo prison. 700 inmates have been sent to other jails, including the leader of one of Paraguay's biggest drug cartels, Armando Javier Rotella. He was in charge of what's known as the jungle, an area of the prison where he had been living with his pregnant wife, three pit bull terriers, several fighting cockerels, and where he ran a small supermarket. Davina Gupta spoke to journalist Santi Caneri Tamaran from the capital, Asuncion.
According to the president of Paraguay, Santiago Peña, the massive operation inside Tacumbu prison was needed because Javier Rotella, a narco big boss of the mafia, was ruling the prison instead of the state. It was not the government or the police who was ruling the prison. It was Javier Rotella. So this operation with 2,000 soldiers and policemen went inside the prison for the first time in years. So this was a very brutal operation because a policeman died in service and another 11 inmates that were inside that also died because the shoots inside during the morning.
It seems like a large-scale operation, but for 2 months, Javier Rotella was allowed to run the prison with his gang. And from the reports, that part of the jail was known as the jungle. He was living with his pregnant wife, three pit bulls. How?
It's difficult to understand from Europe where the prisons are very well controlled, no? Here, Tacumbu is the biggest prison in Paraguay, where more or less 3,000 to 4,000 inmates live here in the area, with only 40 guardians, or maybe 30, depending in the night or the day. So there is an agreement between inmates and guardians and government to stay quiet without making many noise, but everybody doing many illegal businesses around the inmates because there is no way to get food or to get drugs. And there is many people that need drugs to live because they are addicts. And there is no way to get all these things or the basic services inside the prison without paying. And you have to pay for your jail. You have to pay for everything, for the soap, for the water. And you pay to other inmates and to other guardians and not to the state. So Javier Rotella was like the boss of this mafia inside the prison. And he was taking money from all the inmates. At the same time, he was building his own palace inside the prison. The Tacumbu prison is very big, so it's divided in different spaces. One of them is the jungle, where he was planning new criminal acts in Paraguay and in Brazil. And this place is big enough to have his own room with computers, with internet, with phones. He had this machine to pay with credit card. But yeah, it's very crazy to see inside a prison. And it's possible because corruption.
From what I was reading, according to reports from the National Mechanism for the Prevention of Torture, almost 80% of inmates have not seen a judge. And it can take between 6 months to 3 years on an average to get to the courts as well.
I have been working with them for the last 10 years. I was a volunteer for 3 years. They explained that the corruption in the justice system in Paraguay is so huge that there is at least 80% of the population inside the prisons that cannot see a judge yet. They didn't went to a trial. So they can stay inside Tacumbu, for example, for 3 months, 6 months, 3 years, that people have been in Tacumbu for 5 or 6 years without knowing if they are guilty or not.
Journalist Santi Caneri Tamarin. A show by the Swedish pop legends ABBA is estimated to have contributed more than $400 million to the London economy in its first year. ABBA's Voyage show, which is a virtual concert featuring projections of the band, has packed out the arena in Stratford in East London. Figures show it's pumped money into less affluent areas too. Our entertainment correspondent Colin Patterson has the details on all the money, money, money the 3D avatars have been making.
Voyage opened in May last year in a purpose-built arena, 2 minutes' walk from what was the 2012 Olympic Stadium. In the following 12 months, more than 1 million people saw the ABBA show, with a fifth coming from outside the UK. It brought in £320 million to the London economy. ABBA's arena can be fully dismantled and rebuilt elsewhere. It found its current location with the help of the London Legacy Development Corporation, which was created to redevelop East London after the Olympics. Mark Camley is the Executive Director for Park Operations and Venues.
We were able to find them, as I say, on the park, which is spare at the moment because it will soon be housing. We're in constant discussion with them about how long they would like to stay. We are delighted with how well it has gone, but recognise that actually building housing is also important for London. So, but while they're here, we all want to enjoy it.
ABBA have sung about empty houses, but it's new houses which will eventually force them to move. Their lease ends in 3 years. The band will hope that today's figures increase the chance of it being renewed.
Colin Patterson. Still to come in the Global News podcast.
We all remember our childhood, the decorations, the smell of the Christmas tree. But come on, times have changed. We are in an ecological transition, a climate transition.
Is it time to ditch buying a real Christmas tree for the sake of the planet? The Indian Parliament has passed three new bills in a significant overhaul of the colonial-era penal code. The Home Minister, Amit Shah, said the new bills prioritise justice over punishment, but rights campaigners say parts of the new terrorism laws threaten freedom of expression. Here's Lipika Pelham.
The new laws quickly passed through both houses of the Indian Parliament over 2 days. The legal overhaul is Prime Minister Narendra Modi's Hindu nationalist government's latest effort to remove symbols of colonial rule from India's educational and political institutions. The bills remove references to the British monarchy and redefine terrorism offences. New provisions include the death penalty for those convicted of the rape of a child or taking part in mob lynchings, as well as a 20-year minimum sentence for gang rape. Adultery and gay sex are not listed as crimes in the new bill. Transgender has been included in the definition of gender.
Lipika Pelham. Rudy Giuliani, a close ally of Donald Trump and once one of his lawyers, has filed for bankruptcy. It comes a week after he was ordered to pay nearly $150 million to two Georgia election workers for repeatedly lying that they'd carried out electoral fraud in favor of Joe Biden in the 2020 presidential campaign. On Wednesday, Mr. Giuliani was told by a judge he must pay the penalty immediately. His response? His lawyers have filed papers listing his debts at around $500 million and his assets at less than $10 million. I asked our correspondent in Washington, Gary O'Donoghue, why?
Because he's broke. I mean, he simply doesn't have the money to pay his liabilities. I mean, these are liabilities. Some of these are won't necessarily be realised to the extent that the lawyers suggest, but they say it could be up to $500 million. You've got this whopping great award in Georgia last week, $148 million, much more than the women themselves were actually seeking. And he's got various other outstanding debts, including to the Internal Revenue Service that collects taxes, to the state tax authorities in New York. And interestingly, he lists Joe Biden's son Hunter as one of his creditors, and that follows another court case. So basically, Rudy Giuliani is saying, I simply haven't got the cash to pay for this, and one way out of that is a bankruptcy agreement, which, of course, the court will have to agree to and hasn't yet.
They have to agree to it, do they? Because it's an interesting thing, the US bankruptcy protection status.
Well, I'm no bankruptcy lawyer, but this will have to go through a hearing and go before a judge before it's approved. You simply can't just sort of decide these things. So they will take a look at that, take a look at his assets, I'm sure. Bear in mind, he has been accused in the past of trying to avoid paying legal fees. For example, he was ordered to pay the legal fees for these two election workers in Georgia, a couple of $100,000, and that wasn't forthcoming. So a lot of legal jeopardy. And of course, it does sort of hamper his attempts and his ability to stand by Donald Trump's side and be part of his campaign and part of his information war over the 2020 election, which is what Donald Trump relied on quite a lot of the time.
Gary O'Donoghue in Washington. British and French border officials are claiming success in reducing the number of small boats crossing the English Channel. Britain has spent hundreds of millions in helping the French stop the sea crossings to England, but tens of thousands of people are still attempting the dangerous journey. Andrew Harding reports from Calais.
It's about 4 a.m. now and I'm walking along the beach some distance south of Calais, dunes on my left. It's a cold, clear night, very calm, good opportunity for migrants trying to get across the channel here and just run into a couple of French policemen. They say that about 20 minutes ago they stopped a boat from getting into the water just up ahead here. The policemen were saying they use thermal imaging, a lot of equipment paid for here by British government, which has recently been giving a lot of money to the French authorities to try and support them in blocking the migrants from crossing the channel. Daylight, and in Calais, a visit by British border police watching drones in action.
So we can't even see the drone, but look at these images that they're taking. You can see the beach and then the vegetation.
French and British officials talk with some enthusiasm of growing intelligence coordination and about the impact of almost £500 million in UK funding being spent over here.
We have funded a doubling of the number of law enforcement personnel on the French coast.
Chris Eastall runs the Home Office's Small Boats Command.
We have seen significant improvements in prevention of small boat launches. We've seen a reduction in the number of arriving individuals this year in this way by over one-third. And we've also seen the number of boats reduced by 45% year-to-date.
But in Calais, Juliette Delaplace from the French charity Secours Catholique is not convinced by tougher police measures or British threats to send migrants to Rwanda.
The situation is horrific. It is worse than before. Yes, there have been slight decrease, slight change in the number of people going to the UK through the years. It will come again. People will adapt. The networks will adapt. It is not a long-term policy. It is not a functioning policy. The long-term policy that has to be implemented is to open safe and legal pathways to the UK because people are dying at this border.
We've just come away from the beach to a nearby bus stop and run into a group of perhaps a dozen migrants. Some of them, particularly the children, are wrapped in foil blankets that have been given to them by a local charity. It looks like they've just abandoned their attempts to cross the channel. There's a girl here, 17-year-old Faisal. She says she's from Iraq and she's here with a family of six. Did you try and cross?
Yeah, I tried, but the boat was broken and I don't going. The water was up.
The waves get bigger.
Yeah, I have no place to go. I have no chance.
You're very sad.
Yeah, very sad.
So what do you think will happen to you?
I have no idea. Just sitting and show how my life is bad, bad, bad.
Faisal from Iraq, ending that report from Andrew Harding. The month of December sees the Christmas tree industry doing a roaring trade. Millions of young firs are harvested every year from plantations which, in most cases, are treated with chemicals to encourage growth. In the Burgundy Mountains in France, local activists demanding that people change their habits and stop the Christmas tree monoculture. Hugh Schofield reports.
For some people up here in the Burgundy Hills, Christmas trees are not an ancient festive symbol, but an ecological danger.
Là, on voit, y a pas d'herbe.
In this small plantation, you can see the effects of chemical treatment. The ground beneath is dead. The grass has disappeared. Good for the trees, no competition, no predators, but bad for wildlife, bad for rivers. For Muriel André, a local farmer and activist, the conclusion is clear. We must wean ourselves off our seasonal need for baby firs.
We all remember our childhood, the decorations, the smell of the Christmas tree. But come on, times have changed. We are in an ecological transition, a climate transition. Everything that pollutes has got to stop.
More than a million saplings are being cut every year in the Burgundy Hills and then transported in lorries down to cities like here in Paris, where there is evidence that consumers increasingly are asking questions about how Christmas trees are cultivated and the potential consequences for the environment.
Oui, l'environnement rentre dans la réflexion.
Yes, the environment is definitely part of my decision, but it's tough. Do I buy a tree which will last for 2 weeks or something plastic which has to come from a factory?
Where they grow the trees, I guarantee they're using a heap of chemicals, and that's land that could be used for other purposes. Nowadays, whenever we buy anything, ecology is part of our considerations.
Back in the Burgundy Hills, that growing ecological awareness among urban consumers is having an effect. Here at Nodé and Company, one of the biggest producers of Christmas trees, it's 2 weeks before Christmas and the end of the rush. Most of this year's trees have been netted and dispatched. It's a moment to show off what they say is the progress that they've made towards more responsible cultivation. In this plantation, for example, they've reduced the amount of chemical treatment and there's grass and weeds growing between the young trees. Martin Nodé is the company's director general.
We've made huge progress and today our plantations have become a refuge for biodiversity. There are plants and animals. It's out of respect for this beautiful countryside, which we love too.
Producers argue that Christmas trees take up only 1% of viable agricultural land in this area. That's true. But it's also true that the cultivation of Christmas trees is almost entirely non-organic, and that inevitably has some consequences on the natural world all around.
Hugh Schofield. Finally, Nicholas Winterton was a young British stockbroker who, in the months leading up to World War II, helped to save nearly 700 children from the Nazis by bringing them from Prague to London. That story has provided the inspiration for a new film called One Life. It's being released on January the 1st and it stars the Oscar-winning actor Anthony Hopkins. He's been speaking to our culture editor, Katie Russell.
There was nothing heroic about it.
Sir Nicholas Winton saved 669 children from the Nazis.
It's just a question of organisation and work. But I mean, at no time I was in any imminent danger.
The train now arriving at platform one is the delayed 847 international train.
The trains became known as the Kinder Transport when this modest London stockbroker helped mainly Jewish children from the former Czechoslovakia escape to Britain. And a new film, One Life, charts the story.
Do you ever think about the children and what happened to them?
Yes, I do from time to time. Do you?
No, not really. Well, maybe a little, recently.
Sir Anthony Hopkins is a tour de force as the older Nicholas Winton.
Winton had no sentimentality about it. He didn't want to be regarded as a hero.
I wondered how much responsibility you felt taking on the role of Sir Nicholas Winton.
I admired his sense of anonymity. He didn't want to be exposed or revealed. I think he was quite a remarkable man because of his humility.
Nicholas Winton kept what he did secret for 50 years. But in 1988, he appeared on the BBC's That's Life programme in episodes that are memorable even all these decades on.
We asked as many as possible of these grown-up children to get in touch with us so they'd have the chance to thank Mr. Winton personally. Can I ask, is there anyone in our audience tonight who owes their life to Nicholas Winton? If so, could you stand up, please?
Everyone in the front five rows did.
Mr. Winton, would you like to turn round?
Including Renata Collins.
I had a temperature of 104 and chicken pox, and my mother didn't want to put me on the train. And our doctor said, if you don't put her on this train, she'll never go.
Renata Collins was on the last train that made it out before Hitler reached Prague. 64 of her family members, including her parents, were murdered by the Nazis.
I'm still finding out, actually, after 84 years.
And when it comes to Nicholas Winton, when did you find out that you had been on one of the trains?
1988, when the BBC wrote to me in Cornwall, would I come up to Elstree Studios? We often wondered who had brought us.
And what kind of a man was he in your experience?
He was very introverted. He didn't want anybody to know, actually. He didn't want any accolade.
It's believed 6,000 people are alive today because of Winton's efforts.
Ordinary people wouldn't stand for this if they knew what was actually happening.
You have a lot of faith in ordinary people.
I do, because I'm an ordinary person.
Johnny Flynn plays the young Winton.
I know films don't change the world, but they can make people think for a bit, and it is up to people to stand up for what they believe is right, and hopefully this story can awaken that.
And Anthony Hopkins agrees.
What is tragic is this whole wave of prejudice building again. But like Nicholas Winton says, the only way through is compromise. Give thought and heed to the other person's point of view instead of the culture we now live in. No, you're wrong, I'm right. It's appalling.
These days, as well as appearing in films, Anthony Hopkins is a social media star. He has nearly 5 million followers on Instagram alone.
What drives you? Who is the real Anthony Hopkins?
Oh, the real Anthony Hopkins. Well, I'm surprised I'm still here. I've been a sinner all my life. I've been a bad boy. I'm just grateful to get up in the morning. I paint and I play the piano and I write music. I have to because we're a long time dead. And I relish every moment I've got now. I've been through all kinds of crises, I suppose, as we all do. And I've come out of this side of it and I think, well, whatever happens now, I've had the best life I could ever imagine. And what more is there, really?
Anthony Hopkins ending that report by Katie Razzle. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. This edition was mixed by Joe McCartney and the producer was Emma Joseph. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye.